Radio Catskill. From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me. Well, tonight we have a scoop on which local notable is going to the biggest hot dog eating contest in the world at Nathan's in Coney Island. Camille O'Brien, returning to her Brooklyn roots, one of 10 women competing in the big contest on Friday. She joins us in studio to talk all about it in the second half of the program. Also, we continue our coverage of federal funding cuts hitting home in our area, this time talking about the impacts of the Hurleyville Arts Center. Radio Catskill's Genevieve Hartnett talks to Lourdesa Hunt coming up in a moment. We also do have some news from around New York State, including the ratcheting up of beach safety after a Sullivan County woman was bitten by a shark in Long Island. But first, leaders in Sullivan County are speaking out forcefully against recent anti-Semitic incidents targeting Orthodox Jewish pedestrians in the towns of Woodburn and South Fallsburg. According to the reports, eggs were thrown at multiple individuals walking along Route 42 on Sunday, prompting an ongoing investigation by the town of Fallsburg Police Department. While no injuries were reported, at least one incident took place in front of a synagogue, and all of the targets were visibly Orthodox Jewish residents or visitors. The Sullivan County Legislature, along with the Executive Director of the County's Human Rights Commission, joined the newly formed Sullivan County Coalition Against Antisemitism in condemning these attacks. In a statement, Legislative Chair Nadia Raj said, quote, "These assaults were clearly anti-Semitic in nature, inexcusable in every way, and instilled fear in the Orthodox Jewish community, whom we are proud to call neighbors. This legislature will not minimize nor stand for such displays of hate in Sullivan County, and we fully support local law enforcement's efforts to expose and prosecute the perpetrators." End quote from Nadia Raj. Ramon Wilson, Executive Director of Sullivan County Human Rights Commission, wrote to Coalition Chair and local attorney Jacob Billig, saying, quote, "No one in our community should live in fear or be subjected to violence and harassment based on their faith. These violations of human dignity are wholly incompatible with the values we uphold as county and as a commission committed to justice, equality, and respect for all." End quote from Ramon Wilson. Sullivan County Coalition Against Antisemitism launched earlier this year and was formed in response to growing concerns about bias and harassment in the region. Anyone with information about these incidents is urged to contact the Town of Fallsburg Police Department. In New York State news, a judge says it's time to reinstate the policy that prisons put on hold during the Wildcat strikes at the beginning of the year. The state judge is ordering prisons to comply with state law and resume the policy that limits the use of solitary confinement. Jung Yoon Han from the New York Public News Network has more. Thank you, Jung Yoon. According to News 12 Hudson Valley, a 20-year-old woman from Sullivan County sustained minor injuries after being bitten on the left leg and foot while swimming at Jones Beach State Park last Wednesday. Officials believe the incident was likely caused by a juvenile sand tiger shark. The woman was transported to Nassau County University Medical Center for treatment. Authorities suspect the shark was drawn close to shore by fish activity nearby. Following the incident, swimming was suspended for several hours while New York State Police and lifeguards conducted aerial and on-the-water surveillance to ensure the area was safe before reopening it to the public. In response, Governor Kathy Hochul announced enhanced surveillance measures at Long Island State Park beaches that include an increase to 28 patrol drones across beach locations, 8 newly trained drone operators for a total of 48 among staff, and a specialized night-capable enterprise drone with thermal imaging and flotation drop capability assigned to State Park Police. Governor Hochul said in a statement, quote, "We are continuing to strengthen our shark surveillance capabilities and safety tactics at these beaches to help protect these treasured summertime traditions," end quote from the governor. Long Island officials say extra patrols will be on the lookout for sharks as well as for boating safety violations this holiday weekend. Bruce Blakeman is Nassau County Executive.
We will have our police out, and they will be strictly enforcing voting while under the influence. Do not do that. Also, if you are in any kind of motorized boat or wave runner, just remember to adhere to all of the rules on the water, especially the speed in the inlets.
The things to keep in mind if you're swimming near the ocean or its inlets this weekend. If you happen to be in or around some of the inland water a little bit closer to our geographic listening area, there are other precautions you should take. Specifically, the National Park Service is reminding folks that if you're recreating in, on, or around the scenic Delaware River, you should have a life jacket and it should fit properly. The river can be deceptive and dangerous. On average, 2 people drown every year on the Upper Delaware River. So don't overestimate your swimming abilities. Experienced and strong swimmers have drowned in the river in the past, as well as inexperienced swimmers. Those in a boat are also recommended to wear a life jacket. Wearing a life jacket and wearing it correctly is the safest thing you can do while on or in the river. Life jackets should be in good condition, and they should fit snugly to the person so that the life jacket can't slide over somebody's head when it's pulled upon. And now we have local arts and culture news as arts funding faces cutbacks across. Apologies, we're having some technical difficulties here on the local edition. We'll be getting ready for the program here in just a moment. This is Radio Catskill. Recently to
truth, independence, fairness, transparency, respect, excellence, NPR. Donate. Thanks.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me here on 4th of July Eve. Well, tonight we've got an investigative reporting on a long-running Orange County murder case. And after a state employment board arbitrator rules an Ulster County farm must enter into a contract with its unionized workers, it's starting to look like the farm may reject the contract. Plus, a plane crashed yesterday at Stewart International Airport. We've got all those stories and more from Philip Pantuso, Times Union Hudson Valley, coming up in just a moment. But first, we have the big news of the afternoon, national news out of Washington that will have impacts here locally. House Republicans passed President Trump's mega bill this afternoon. And since it passed the Senate on Tuesday, this package is now ready for President Trump's desk. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt has announced that the president will sign the bill into law tomorrow, July 4th, at 5 p.m. What the president has been calling the big, beautiful bill contains much of his domestic agenda. We're starting the show tonight with reactions to its passing from lawmakers in our region, starting with a prominent New York Democrat who refuses to call it a big, beautiful bill. In a release titled Statement from Governor Kathy Hochul on the final passage of Trump's big ugly bill in the House, the governor says, quote, "Today's vote makes it official. All 7 New York Republicans in Congress voted to rip health care away from 1 million New Yorkers and jeopardize SNAP benefits for nearly 3 million more. They had 2 chances to stand up to Donald Trump and fight for the people they serve. They failed both times, gambling with their constituents' lives to pay for billionaire tax breaks." End quote. Hochul then went on to name-check those Republicans, including Representative Lawler of New York's 17th District in the Hudson Valley and Representative Stefanik of the 21st District. And Hochul addressed their constituents, saying, quote, "Your members of Congress may have given up on you, but I never will," end quote from Governor Hochul. Representative Rob Bresnahan, Republican of Pennsylvania's 8th District, also released a statement. He said, quote, "This bill delivers on the promise I made to the people of northeastern Pennsylvania by providing the largest working-class tax cuts in American history, eliminating taxes on tips and overtime, and securing the southern border. We also protect and strengthen Medicaid by cracking down on the fraud, waste, and abuse that is driving the program toward collapse Most importantly, we work directly with the White House to ensure all our hospitals in northeastern Pennsylvania will qualify for the funding they need to stay open and protect critical health care access for our communities. End quote from Representative Bresnahan. On to Pat Ryan, the Democrat representing New York's 18th district, said, quote, "Today I voted strongly against this bill, which is a betrayal of my constituents and the American people. The bill is fundamentally unfair and un-American. I am furious that it is now law. This big, ugly betrayal is a triple whammy. It makes devastating cuts to health care and food programs while driving up costs for everyone, gives massive tax breaks to big corporations and the ultra-rich instead of the middle class, and irresponsibly adds nearly $4 trillion to the national debt. Families will lose health care, hospitals will close, kids will go hungry, energy prices will go up. Also, the wealthiest 0.1% can get even richer." End quote from Representative Ryan. So as you can hear here, starkly different interpretations of this news of the day. I'm just giving you the reactions from the lawmakers and their camps in their own words so that you can hear what they have to say today. Moving back to Representative Elise Stefanik, who Governor Hochul mentioned. Stefanik said, quote, "Promises made, promises kept. I was proud to stay in Congress to vote to pass the one big, beautiful bill to deliver on President Trump's historic mandate to enact the largest tax cut in American history, turbocharge economic growth, secure our borders, restore energy dominance, cut wasteful spending, and deliver peace through strength." End quote. Stefanik went on to say that as dean of the New York Republican delegation, she was proud to help lead the successful effort to increase the state and local tax, or SALT, deduction cap to $40,000. Representative Mike Lawler, who worked extensively on making the SALT cap increase part of this mega bill, posted on social media today, quote, "We're delivering long overdue SALT relief by quadrupling the deduction so middle class families in the Hudson Valley get more of their hard earned dollars back," end quote from Representative Lawler. And as of late this afternoon, I didn't see any statement yet from Representative Josh Riley of New York's 19th on his site or social media. So that's how we're going to leave things on this roundup of lawmakers' reaction to the passage of the mega bill. And that's exactly where we start things with Philip Pantuso, Times Union Hudson Valley, because he has reporting on that SALT cap increase. I should note that I spoke to Philip earlier this afternoon. It was actually just minutes before the mega bill actually passed. So when we were talking, we didn't know for sure that it would pass and that it would include the SALT cap increase, but it did seem likely. Well, Philip starts us off by recapping some of the history on this, including Philip starts off by explaining the history of how the cap was first enacted by Republicans in Congress about 8 years ago.
A bill that was passed in Congress initially in 2017 put a cap on state and local tax deductions of $10,000. Basically, it just did what it said. It said you can only deduct up to $10,000 on your state and local income tax returns. And that was considered a win for most Republicans at the time, but those Republicans who are from blue states, particularly ones with high property taxes like New York, they felt like this was really hurting their constituents. Before the SALT tax,
and that's it for the local edition tonight. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me. This tomorrow's a holiday.
$10,000 is obviously quite low. Patricia will not be here, and many people, especially high earners, would deduct far more than that before the cap. So, for those Republicans in high-income states with high property taxes, particularly representing some high-income districts, this has been a big policy to them. And that's probably no more true than for Representative Mike Lawler, who, of course, represents the lower Hudson Valley. He was first elected a few years ago. This has been probably his number one policy initiative. And he led the caucus of Republicans, including other New York representatives from further upstate into Long Island, in negotiating not
if you missed my conversation
cap,
with Camille
but,
here
but raising
in studio,
it
you can find
as
it at
part of the Trump One Big Beautiful Bill.
It's really cool because she's there's this concept of New York being a high tax state. And a talking point I've heard more from New York Democrats, especially as we look back the last, you know, 4 to 8 years, then Governor Cuomo would say that, New York, you know, pays more to the federal government than it gets back in terms of, like, you know, federal benefits. Is that concept at play in here? And if so, is that going to be less of a talking point moving forward?
It's definitely at play. So what's happening here is that the cap is going to raise from $10,000 to $40,000. So it's quadrupled. And an analysis from a nonprofit data firm called USA Facts found that the higher cap would come at the cost of billions of dollars over 10 years because of the resulting loss of federal tax revenue through deductions. So, yeah, this is a little bit of robbing Peter to pay Paul, which is probably the theme of this package overall. But, yeah, so, you know, this is good if you're a homeowner in the lower Hudson Valley or Long Island or really anywhere else, and you were making enough money and had enough other deductions that you would go over the old cap. It's probably bad news if you rely on really any of the programs in New York State that require federal funding.
Okay, well, I'll leave it to the listener to decide which camp they are in. And then we'll move on to the next story. And this is about a farm in Ulster County, and they have to enter in a collective bargaining agreement with its unionized workers. So this sounds like an interesting labor story.
Yeah, this one requires a little bit of background as well. So in 2019, the state legislature passed landmark labor laws that granted agricultural workers, including guest farm workers on H-2A visas, the right to unionize. Previously, they had not had that right because, you know, most of them are temporary or seasonal employees. Many of them are not even documented American citizens. And in that time, about 15 farms in New York, their workers have voted to unionize. One of them is Papiglia Farms in Marlborough in lower Ulster County. And really what's been happening there, this is playing out at a couple of those farms that have voted to unionize, is the farm owners have been challenging the validity of the union. They basically say that they don't think that the organizing that's being done, mostly by United Farm Workers, which is a big farm union that I think is probably headquartered in California, they don't think that that it's been above board, basically. And so they've been challenging this with the State Public Employment Relations Board. So we've been reporting on this story for a couple of years now, because it's been a little over 2 years, actually, since the workers at Papiglia Farms voted to unionize. There's 120 of them. It's an apple farm. And the Public Employment Relations Board in April 2023 certified that union. What Papiglia Farms owners have been saying is that, again, they don't think that that certification was proper. They said that not a majority or not enough of the workers signed the dues authorization cards. What they wanted to have instead was a secret ballot. We've also been reporting into some issues of kind of workplace, like poor workplace conditions and poor labor conditions at some of these farms as well. So this has been kind of playing out at the state board level for a couple of years. And what happened this past week is that the State Public Employment Relations Board had appointed an arbitrator to essentially decide the case for them. And the arbitrator, in his decision, he wrote that a clear majority of workers at Papiglia chose to join the union, and the union was lawfully certified. This process has dragged on for years, and Papiglia has exhausted its legal options. It must recognize its workers' right under New York state law to a union, and it imposed a contract. This was part of a decision that included three other farms, which our friends at New York Focus have also reported on. What our story shows is that at least this farm, and I think a couple of the other ones as well, the workers or the farm owner is refusing to recognize that union, basically for the same reasons as before, and he's saying he's not going to honor that contract. So that kind of is where things stand right now. It's not, you know, it's not really clear what the next step would be. Certainly, if you know the farm owner seems to have exhausted his legal recourse with the state labor board, and so this could become a bigger issue.
Can you just talk a little bit more about the Public Employment Relations Board? You know, they had this arbitrator that made this ruling that the farm must enter into this collective bargaining agreement. If they do refuse or stall or otherwise resist, what levers does this board have to try to secure an outcome?
So the United Farm Workers, the union that represents this farm in Ulster County and the other ones are part of this arbitration, said it will take legal action to enforce the contracts if the farms do not voluntarily follow them. The State Public Employment Relations Board, which handles these public sector labor disputes, could bring the farms to court to force them to comply, but it's not yet indicated if it will do so. So that's kind of the next step, is this would become a court fight rather than like a labor board fight. And it just remains to be seen, I guess, whether or not the farms themselves will change their tune here. What they're saying basically is like that not only do they find that the process by which the union was formed was illegitimate, but that some aspects of the contract would put them in violation of some federal statutes regarding farm worker labor. You know, that may just be a fig leaf. The other option here is they could try a different form of recertification if they wanted to do that secret ballot, but it does not seem like, you know, the United Farm Workers said they were happy to do that before they went through this arbitration process. But that's, you know, the arbitration process ended with a ruling from the board that would oversee this saying that it was properly certified. So I'm not really sure why they would need to redo that certification.
It's the Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. I'm talking with Philip Pantuso, Times Union Hudson Valley. Philip, looks like you got an update on, you know, there's every once in a while there's a case, usually a murder case that you're following. It takes a long time. This one's been taking quite a long time, and it has lots of other implications. So remind folks what this case is and what's the latest.
Yeah, so this is the Megan McDonald murder case. Megan McDonald was a 20-year-old young woman who was killed in 2003 in Orange County. And the case has dragged on for, you know, over two decades. There was a high profile arrest of a suspect, Edward Holly, by state police about 2 years ago now. And what was notable at the time, and I'm sure we talked about it, was that state police arrested and charged Holly without participating with the district attorney's office in Orange County, which is unusual, because what happens when law enforcement arrests somebody and bring charges is that prosecutors then have a predetermined period of time. It depends on the crime, but it's usually about 6 days to present the evidence to a grand jury for an indictment. And so, you know, law enforcement and the prosecuting agency need to be working hand in hand to make sure they're on the same page. That clearly was not happening in this case. And the result of that was that the Orange County District Attorney, David Hoover, he said he was completely caught off guard when the state police arrested and charged Ed Holly initially. And he took the whole 6 day period, and rather than bringing evidence to a grand jury, he decided to recuse himself from the case because he had represented a person of interest in that case before he was the district attorney when he was in private practice. And the result of that was that a judge had to order Ed Hawley to be released, and special prosecutors were appointed. They had to familiarize themselves with the case. They had to gather their own evidence, present that to a grand jury, which eventually handed up an indictment, which led us to the trial that I talked about earlier this year. Right. 7-week trial that ended in a hung jury. That recusal by David Hoover postponed the case by nearly 2 years. Now, the story that we have out this week by Lana Bellamy, it's kind of a complicated story, but a really interesting investigative story that we have exclusively, was that David Hoover's reasoning for recusing himself from the case, it's not totally sure if it's accurate or true. So what he told the public was that he had provided legal representation for a man named Andre Thurston. Andre Thurston was previously a suspect in the McDonald case. And even today, police and prosecutors claim that Ed Hawley did not act alone, but they haven't charged anybody else. The reason might be is because Andre Thurston died in 2010. So David Hoover was like, okay, I represented this person. He's used the term legal representation to the public. And then when he recused himself for the case, he had to apply for a special prosecutor. He had to basically get that approved by the state Supreme Court. And in that application, he wrote that he had provided representation for this man, Andre Thurston, and therefore it would give the appearance of impropriety if he prosecuted the case out of his office. Our story reveals that in a subsequent investigation by a grievance committee, he's saying, actually, I did not represent this man. So the grievance committee is looking at some misconduct allegations that Megan McDonald's sister and mother filed regarding the timing and circumstances of Hoover's recusal. Megan McDonald's mother and sister feel that David Hoover recused himself from this case basically because he didn't want to cooperate with the state police. They have a wide range of allegations saying that he's attempted to kind of interfere with the case, that he doesn't think the case is strong enough, so he doesn't want to prosecute it and potentially lose it. And if he was going to recuse himself at the very last possible moment because he represented somebody back in 2008 is when these meetings happened, why didn't he recuse himself as soon as he became the district attorney, which was in 2014? They basically feel like he's just messing with the case and trying to delay it or torpedo it. So as part of those misconduct allegations, this grievance committee, which oversees the judicial district in Orange County, is looking at the circumstances of that recusal. And in one of his written responses to the grievance committee, which we were able to get a hold of, he said that he had only met informally with Andre Thurston for a total of 40 minutes beforehand, and that there was no recognized standard by which that establishes an attorney-client relationship. And so the reason this matters basically is that whether or not the Orange County District Attorney and his office prosecute this case is not immaterial to the pursuit of justice. Like I already said, it delayed the trial by 2 years at no small cost to Orange County taxpayers. And it meant that special prosecutors had to be brought in who were not as familiar with the case, whereas David Hoover, you know, his office has been ostensibly part of this investigation since Megan McDonald was killed in 2003 and since he was elected as district attorney in 2014. It's been, 22 years and counting since Megan McDonald was killed. And the family certainly feels like we're well past time to have some sense of justice here.
Yeah, really. But what are the next steps here? Because like you say, like, you know, the family would like some kind of closure, and timing is an issue. So what's likely to happen and what's the time frame?
Yeah, so there's this ongoing investigation into those misconduct complaints. The committee is still doing its work. They haven't rendered any decision on that front yet. They may find that, you know, they may find that the reason for his recusal